Real remakes, real markets, the ops world revealed. Operations, leadership, notes from the field.
Welcome back to the Operations Leadership Podcast, Notes from the Field. I'm Gautam Basu, professor of practice at the Aalto School of Business. And this is a segment where we step out of the classroom and into the arena where theory meets practice. So today we're going to talk about a current event that's been in the news lately, and it's really about 21 miles. 21 miles, that's the width of the Strait of Hormuz at its narrowest point, a sliver of deep water pinched between Iran to the north and Oman to the south. And right now, as we speak in the spring of 2026, those 21 miles are probably the most consequential piece of geography on Earth. Not because of its beauty, not because of its strategic military significance alone, but because through those 21 miles, until about a month ago, flowed the circulatory system of the modern global economy. And so as we know, those of you have been following the news, on February 28th, 2026, the United States and Israel launched Operation Epic Fury. This is a major air and maritime assault on the Iranian military infrastructure targeting command centers, missile sites, naval vessels, and air defenses. And during the days, the first days of these military operations, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps issued a warning that they would echo through every commodity trading floor, every shipping office, every farm cooperative, and every semiconductor fab on the planet. In essence, they stated that the Strait of Hormuz was closed and any vessels trying to cross it would be set ablaze. And through March, Iran has made 21 confirmed attacks on merchant ships, major carriers, including Maersk, MSC, Hapag-Lloyd, CMA, and CGM, which have all suspended their operations through the strait, and shipping traffic has been squeezed basically to a trickle, with only just 21 tankers transiting through the route in the first 3 weeks of the war, compared with more than 100 ships daily before this conflict started. We can assume that this is not a drill and this is not a rehearsal. This is probably the biggest supply chain disruption in a half a century. The closure of the strait has been described as the largest disruption of the energy supply since the 1970s energy crisis and the largest in the history of the global oil market. So let's get into the numbers and let's understand what this actually means, not just about the pump, but across multiple different industries that touches modern society and modern life. And then let's talk about what operations leaders should be drawing from this right now. Before we get into the disruption, let me just establish a baseline, because I think many people, even in business circles, don't fully appreciate what the Strait of Hormuz actually is. At its narrowest point, the strait is only 21 miles wide, connecting the Persian Gulf to the Gulf of Oman and the Arabian Sea, and ultimately to global markets. It has two unidirectional shipping lanes, one for vessels going in and one for vessels going out. And they are each about 2 miles wide with a buffer zone in between. So just think about that for a while. 2 miles. The combined economic output of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Iraq, Kuwait, and Qatar has been funneling through 2-mile-wide corridors of water. That's kind of mind-blowing. And in 2023, oil flows through the waterway averaged approximately 20.9 million barrels per day, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, which accounts for about 20% of the global petroleum liquids consumption. That's one out of every 5 barrels of oil consumed anywhere on Earth every day. But it's not just about oil. Roughly 27% of the world's maritime trade in crude oil and petroleum products goes through the strait, and 20% of the global liquefied natural gas trade passes through it as well. In 2024, approximately 84% of the crude oil and condensate shipments through the strait were destined for Asian markets, with China receiving roughly about a third of its oil via this route. And Europe gets about 12 to 14% of its LNG from Qatar, also through this strait. And here's what's even many logistics professionals may not have fully appreciated before this crisis. The Strait of Hormuz is not merely just an energy logistics choke point, but the Persian Gulf is a major hub for global fertilizer production and exports. In the 2020s, the region has accounted for roughly about 30 to 35% of global urea exports and around 20 to 30% of ammonia exports. Overall, up to 30% of internationally traded fertilizers normally transit the Strait of Hormuz. In addition to that, around 30% of the world's helium supply originates from Qatar. Helium is essential for semiconductor manufacturing, MRI machines, aerospace and satellite technology, as well as fiber optic production and scientific research. Jebel Ali in the UAE, the world's ninth largest container port, handles approximately 26 million containers annually, and currently an estimated 150 vessels carrying roughly 450,000 containers are waiting for safe passages through this strait. I want you to sit with that. 450,000 containers. That's not a metaphor. That's not a projection. Those are actual boxes sitting in actual ships anchored in the Gulf of Oman and the surrounding waters, waiting for this war to come to some sort of conclusion. And roughly 400 vessels have been spotted across the Gulf of Oman operating, forming a massive backlog near this logistics choke point. And this is what a choke point failure looks like in the real world. And this one didn't sneak up on us. The threat of the Strait of Hormuz closure has been in every geopolitical risk assessment for 30 years. We knew what it would mean. We just never thought it would actually happen. Now let's direct our attention towards the energy impact, because this is where the cascade begins. Before the war began on February 28th, Brent crude was trading somewhere around $65 a barrel. And within days of the Strait of Hormuz closure announcement, prices surged above $100 a barrel for the first time in 4 years. This essentially reached a peak of around $126 a barrel, and this was rising faster than during any other conflict in recent history. That is approximately a 94% price increase in a matter of weeks. And to give you a historical reference point, the Yom Kippur War of 1973 triggered roughly a 70% increase over several months. We have now blown past that in a fraction of the time. Gasoline prices in the U.S. have soared to nearly $4 a gallon since the start of the conflict. And the Dallas Federal Reserve has been doing some rigorous economic modeling of the various scenarios, and their analysis is quite sobering. A complete cessation of oil exports from the Gulf region removes close to 20% of the global oil supplies from the market, about 80% of that which is shipped to Asia. And a closure of the strait for a single quarter is expected to raise the average WTI price of oil to $98 per barrel and lower global real GDP growth by an analyzed 2.9 percentage points in the second quarter of 2026. Just think about what that means. One quarter of closure minus 2.9 percent percentage points off global GDP growth. And if the closure extends to two quarters, the WTI price rises further to approximately $115 per barrel in Q3 2026. Also, if shipping doesn't resume for those three quarters, prices could reach as high as $132 a barrel, with negative growth impacts persisting through the year end of 2026. The International Energy Agency, or the IEA, moved pretty quickly, where they launched the largest emergency reserve release in history, releasing approximately 400 million barrels of oil from strategic reserves. But here's the supply chain reality that's often missed in these announcements. Releasing reserves is a demand-side buffer. If smooth price spikes in the short term, it does nothing to restore the actual flow of material through the physical supply chain, meaning the ships, the ports, the downstream refineries that were built and configured to receive Gulf crude. From that point of view, oil producers in the Gulf, the difference is largely academic, because as soon as local storage fills up, producers have no choice but to shut down their oil wells. This is why Iraq and Kuwait began curtailing production in early March 2026. So you have, in essence, a situation where oil exists, the storage exists, the demand exists, but a 21-mile logistics choke point is rendering all three of those facts irrelevant. And for LNG specifically, the supply dynamics are even more structurally constrained. Most LNG terminals already operate at a very high percentage of capacity because of the sheer cost of construction. You can't just spin up an alternative liquefaction terminal overnight. The capital investment cycles for LNG infrastructure are measured in decades, and natural gas prices in Asia and Europe rose sharply in the first weeks of the crisis, rising 7% in the United States, which is relatively insulated compared to the far steeper moves in Asian and European spark markets. Qatar Energy was forced to declare a force majeure on all shipments, sending U.S. and European gas prices up approximately 39 to 40% in a single trading session. Now, what's been fascinating from a logistics and geopolitical standpoint is the selective access that Iran has started to grant. Their government has set up what can only be described as a toll booth, allowing Iran to decide whether to grant safe passage to ships for a price. Ships must provide documentation, including information on the crew and ownerships, and the government then decides whether to allow passage. At a reported fee of around $2 million per tanker, that translates to roughly $20 million a day from oil alone, or about $600 million a month. Including LNG, that figure could rise to more than $800 million a month. For context, Egypt earns between $700 and $800 million a month from the Suez Canal in a typical year. So Iran, in effect, is attempting to create a sovereign toll infrastructure out of an internationally recognized transit waterway. An Iran official has now added a new demand to the end of the war, formal recognition of Iran's sovereignty over the Strait of Hormuz. And that is a geopolitical demand with generational implications. And from a supply chain risk standpoint, whoever is advising their procurement organization that this is a short-term disruption that will resolve in weeks needs to revisit their scenario planning. I also want to spend some time on what I consider to be the underreported story here, because the global media, understandably, has been focused on the oil price and the military situation. But the broader commodity cascade is where the long-term operations damage is currently being done. For example, let's talk about fertilizer. Around one-third of the global seaborne fertilizer trade passes through the Strait of Hormuz, according to the United Nations. The cost of an FOB granular urea in Egypt, a bellwether for nitrogen fertilizer globally, has jumped to around $700 per metric ton, up from $400 to $490 before the war began. Urea prices in New Orleans, the major U.S. fertilizer hub, has also risen from $475 per metric ton to around $600 per metric ton. And urea prices have increased by 50% since the start of the war as of late March 2026. Now think about the timing. This is not an abstract economic statistic. This is happening right at the opening of the spring planting window in the Midwest for soy and corn. 54 agricultural groups have written to President Trump calling for market relief, noting as the planting season begins in earnest, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz sent fuel and fertilizer prices skyrocketing. Iran is an important producer of nitrogen-based fertilizers and one of the largest exporters globally, with around 30% of the global urea trade coming out of Iran and the Hormuz-constrained countries. And here's the compounding factor, because nitrogen fertilizer production relies heavily on natural gas as a feedstock. Thus, the rise in energy prices has further amplified production costs. It is estimated that the global fertilizer prices could average 15 to 20% higher during the first half of 2026 if this crisis continues. And unlike oil, the fertilizer sector does not have internationally coordinated strategic reserves, making supply disruptions more difficult to manage. China, another large exporter of fertilizers, has put restrictions on exports to protect its own domestic market, further tightening global supply. Russia and Belarus are positioned to benefit from this vacuum as the world's largest fertilizer export and potash giant, respectively. And while countries entered 2026 with a fairly high buffer stocks of basic food commodities, a hypothetical 5% impact on agricultural yields globally would cause significant food inflation, and emerging market nations are disproportionately exposed. Another commodity which has been affected is helium, because this one surprised a lot of people outside the semiconductor and medical industries. A third of global helium supply travels through the Strait of Hormuz, and clogging transport of a key ingredient in the production of electronic chips. And as we know, semiconductors are a vital component of everything from washing machines to smartphones to cars. This crisis has been further compounded by Iranian missile and drone strikes that forced the closure of Qatar's massive Ras Laffan production plant, with the Qatari government estimating that repairs could take up to 3 to 5 years, the long-term outlook for global helium supply is increasingly grim. 3 to 5 years, that is not a supply chain disruption. That is a structural supply re-architecture. The semiconductor industry already navigating a post-pandemic capacity constraint and geopolitical tensions around Taiwan is now facing a years-long helium supply production problem. About 85% of polyethylene exports from the Middle East transit through the Hormuz Strait. And shortage and backlogs are also raising the prices of packaging, automotive components, and consumer goods. The U.S. defense industry is affected by a near total disruption of critical mineral supply, in particular sulfur through the Strait of Hormuz. And risks are particularly acute for the Asian garment industry, which relies on petrochemicals shipped through the strait to produce synthetic fibers. Aluminum from the UAE could also be impacted, with disruptions most likely to show up as higher prices given the metal's widespread use in industrial manufacturing. And from a logistics perspective, freight rates have quintupled on key routes, while war risk insurance premiums have surged to as high as 10% of a vessel's hull value, adding millions to individual voyage costs. War risk insurance premiums are reportedly 4 to 5 times greater than they were before the conflict. And the Cape of Good Hope rerouting, which we saw tried during the Red Sea crisis of 2024, is being deployed again. Ships rerouted around the Cape of Good Hope faced a detour, adding approximately 10 to 14 days to transit times, with significantly higher fuel cost, insurance premiums, and shipping delays. For context on scale, in the Red Sea crisis, the Strait of Hormuz remained open, and that the rerouting created significant disruptions. Now both corridors are compromised, and the Houthis have announced readiness to escalate and Bob L. Mondab as well. The two great Western maritime shortcuts of the global economy, the Suez Canal and the Persian Gulf approach, are simultaneously under threat. So I'd like to shift gears right now, because this is a podcast about operations leadership and not just a current events commentary. So what should operations leaders be drawing from this? Let me give you my take with six observations. Number one, the return to geography. For three decades, globalization, we operated under an implicit assumption that geography had been defeated, that the efficiency of the global shipping network had made physical distance and physical choke points largely irrelevant to production strategy. Now that assumption is dead. Geography's back. This 21 miles that we've been talking about with the Strait of Hormuz, these are real constraints. They are not just footnotes in a risk register. They need to be the starting point of your operational footprint or supply chain network design. Number two, the insurance market is the early warning system. Before the military announcements, before the diplomatic cables, even before the mainstream media coverage, the insurance markets moved. War risk insurance had a 72-hour cancellation clause, and insurers exercised it. We know that premiums went to 4 to 5 times their pre-conflict levels almost immediately. And for operations leaders, Lloyd's of London and other insurance carriers are your real-time geopolitical intelligence feed. If you're not tracking war risk insurance pricing on your key shipping corridors, you're essentially operating blind. Number three, the toll booth as a governance model. Here's something I find genuinely fascinating from a supply chain governance standpoint. The RAND government has created a tolled passageway that requires ships to provide documentation on crew and ownership and decides on a case-by-case basis whether to grant passage. And what we're watching in real time is a nation state attempting to convert a major global commons into a sovereignty-controlled, revenue-generating piece of infrastructure. Iran is now demanding formal recognition of its sovereignty over the strait as a condition of ending the war. And if that precedent is established in any form, the implications for global shipping governance are profound. Every maritime choke point on Earth is suddenly a potential toll booth. And that is a logical extension of a precedent that's being set right now. Number four, asymmetry in reserve architecture. So the International Energy Agency's emergency reserve release bought time. But notice the structural asymmetry. The fertilizer sector has no internationally coordinated strategic reserves, unlike oil. And we built strategic petroleum reserves over decades of hard policy experience post-1973. We built no equivalent for fertilizer, for helium, for specialty gases, for the array of petrochemical feedstocks that underpin modern manufacturing. And this crisis is going to, or should, trigger serious policy discussion about broadening the strategic reserve concept beyond oil. Number five, the planting season clock. Supply chain disruptions in commodities are not symmetrical in time. A 2-week delay in semiconductor shipment is recoverable. A disruption to fertilizer supply chains that coincides with the spring's planting window in the Northern Hemisphere is not recoverable on the same timeline. For example, you cannot plant corn in August. If farmers cannot get urea in April, that yield impacts manifest into the harvest, and the food price impact follows 6 to 9 months later. Operations leaders need to understand the seasonality of criticality in the commodity chains they depend on. Not all delays are created equal. And last but not least, my sixth observation. This is around the geopolitical resorting of logistics networks. Dozens of vessels broadcasting Chinese ownership or crew presence were operating in the Gulf region to seek safe passage. And Iran has continued shipping crude oil to China, and Beijing is reportedly negotiating to allow Qatari LNG carriers through. What we are watching is not just a military conflict. It is a real-time resorting of the global logistics network along geopolitical affiliation lines. Iran has said that the strait is open to all except the U.S. and its allies. If that principle holds, if the Hormuz passage becomes conditional on your nation's geopolitical alignment, then the architecture of global supply chains will need to be fundamentally rethought. The implications for Nordic companies, European companies, for multinational firms with complex ownership structures are considerable. So what happens next? Let me give you the macro frame and then we'll close. Between the pre-attack date and March 17th, 2026, the S&P 500 fell 2.2% and the Dow declined 4%. And the VIX, which is a measure of expected market volatility, rose by 11.7%. Those are significant but not catastrophic moves in equity markets, and it reflects an assessment that this disruption is severe but likely finite. Markets are pricing a resolution, not a permanent new world order. That may be correct, but it may also be an optimism that the physical supply chain does not share. For example, the Dallas Fed modeling suggests that fourth quarter over fourth quarter global GDP growth in 2026 could fall by as much as 0.2 percentage points if the oil disruption remains limited to one quarter, or 0.3 percentage points if it lasts two quarters, and rising to 1.3 percentage points if the disruption persists for three quarters. And on March 19th, the U.S. Armed Forces began a military campaign to open the strait, and on the 27th of March, the Iran government announced that the strait is closed to any vessel going to and from ports of the U.S., Israel, and their allies. Also in that latter week, the Iran's foreign minister announced that ships from five nations, China, Russia, India, Iraq, and Pakistan, would be allowed to transit. Malaysian and Thai vessels were granted access through separate diplomatic arrangements, and Iran has also agreed to allow humanitarian and fertilizer shipments through the strait to address disruptions to the fertilizer supply during the spring planting season. In the end of March, U.S. Treasury Secretary Bessent said the U.S. would gradually take control over the Strait of Hormuz, and this has become also something that is being discussed in the U.S. government circles in early April. So now we have a situation where military operations are ongoing, selective passages being granted on a country-by-country basis. The Iran government's toll infrastructure is in partial operation, and diplomatic talks between Iran and multiple parties are underway. This is not resolution, this is managed chaos. So the question of whether a military operation to reopen the strait would be strategically and economically viable remains generally open as the recording of this podcast. Even attempting it could trigger a global economic shock. Persistent threats to shipping could take weeks or months to suppress. The honest operational assessment is we are in a period of protected uncertainty with a very high cost of that uncertainty falling disproportionately on Asian economies, on agriculture-producing nations in the Southern Hemisphere, and on the LNG-dependent industrial base of Northern Europe. So let me close with this. The Strait of Hormuz crisis of 2026 will become, I believe, a defining case study in supply chain risk management, not because it was unforeseeable, but precisely because it was foreseeable and the global economy was still exposed. We spent decades optimizing for efficiency, lean inventories, just-in-time delivery, concentrated sourcing from low-cost geographies, single-corridor logistics networks, We have, in the language of systems theory, removed all the slack from the system. And a system with no slack has very limited resilience. So when a shock arrives, and shocks always arise, there is no buffer, no redundancy, no alternative pathway to absorb the disruption. What does leadership in this environment actually look like? It looks like bringing the geopolitical risk function into the supply chain design conversation, not just an afterthought, but as the network architecture stage. It looks like investing in redundant sourcing at the cost of the same efficiency margin and being able to make that case to a CFO who is benchmarking you against the competitors who haven't made that investment yet. It looks like understanding the seasonality and irreversibility of the commodity chains you depend on. And it looks like the tracking of the insurance market, the AIS vessel data, the Lloyd's war risk tables, and the signals that move before the headlines. The world is not becoming less complex. The logistics choke points are not going away. What can change is how prepared we are when they become contested. 21 miles. In supply chain terms, it's nothing. In geopolitical terms, it's everything. That's the Operations Leadership Podcast, Notes from the Field for today. And if you found this valuable, please share it with a colleague. And until next time, keep leading with insight and operating with purpose.
Real names, real markets, the ops world revealed. Operations Leadership, Notes from the Field.